George Mitunas, what is flux? George, how did Genghis Khan count the dead after a battle?
Well, you see, the Mongolian armies were very efficient. And to count dead could be a very laborious process if you just ask one man to count. Let's say there were 100,000 dead, could take him a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you were in a hurry and asked everybody to count, they may count the same bodies several times. So that wouldn't work either. And for the Mongolian armies, it was important to move fast and also to have precise information about the enemy. Mm-hmm. So if they knew how many of the enemy were lost in a particular battle, they would know how many there are left. So it was all had to be very precise intelligence. So they worked out a method where they could do it quickly and accurately. They asked everyone in their army to cut one ear from any of the dead bodies. Then they would just throw the ears in a bag. This way there's no duplication, because if you found already a body with one ear, you wouldn't cut the other one.
Mm.
Now then, as soon as they got all the ears in the bags, on they would hop on the horses and off they go. Then at leisure, while they're riding, each can count their ears by taking it out of the bag and throwing it out.
Okay.
When they have done all that, on the next stop, they get together and they just add all the totals and they have the figure.
And they've got the figure. My God. That's interesting. Wow.
Well,
George, what is flux?
The way I found out about the ears was that I... for the last year, I've been doing historical boxes for my friends. They're sort of like birth year boxes.
Okay.
So I would ask each of my friends what year they were born in, and then I would make like a souvenir box that would contain all kinds of objects and peculiar information or whatever from that particular year. And I asked George Brecht what was... Nobody knows, incidentally, his birth year. So I asked him, what is it, 1923, 1925? He said, oh, 1250.
So, right.
Okay. Right now, therefore, I had to dig up all kinds of information, like what tools were used, or how food was eaten, how it was cooked, what kind of music existed then, and all kinds of other historical and technical facts of that particular year or century.
I see.
And I was going to include an ear.
A human ear?
Yeah, except no hospital will give it to me. They just throw them away. So I need a human ear.
Okay. What other kind of boxes are you have you been doing lately?
Well, I could describe some earlier ones. Like in 1964, Ben Wattier, who is one of the hardcore flux man, we don't like to call flux artist, just the flux man.
Hardcore.
A flux worker.
Okay.
He used to bottle dirty water in little perfume bottles,
uh-huh,
and you know, sell it like for the same price as perfumes. Had a very dirty water. But we haven't sold any so far.
You haven't sold any
so far? So we have many gallons of it saved up for some eventual lucky day when we can dispose of it.
Okay.
Then George Brecht has done a lot of boxes, and I would sort of... he acknowledges like his boxes as an influence partly by Joseph Cornell boxes.
Cornell.
Yeah, so there is like the tradition of the surrealist boxes, and then which was transmitted to George Brecht and Bob Watts by way of Joseph Cornell. Now, George Brecht has done a whole series of puzzles, games and puzzles, and some of the puzzles were like a little ball in a box with a card reading, observe the ball rolling uphill. I could wait all your life waiting for this to happen. Or there were some like what you would call exercises or mind exercises, where there would be one card, and on one third side, George Brecht would say that whatever Ben Watier on the other side says is wrong. Okay. And meanwhile, on the other card, Ben Watier would say whatever George Brecht says is right. Now what happens? If George Brecht is right about Ben Watier, then Ben Watier must be wrong in his statement, which makes George Brecht wrong, which makes again Ben Watier right. So it changes all the time, it oscillates.
And has an oscillation process.
Yeah, and it's like never still. Or like in the 60s, we must have produced 100 different boxes, which most of them had this element of humor. And I think that's what distinguished our boxes from surrealist earlier boxes, or any boxes done by others now.
How big are these boxes, George?
Well, they vary from like just 2 inches or so, and the biggest one would be like a suitcase. So, and all kinds of sizes in between. For instance, there is in 1970, Jeff Hendricks did a little reliquary, which was to complement a flux mass that we did. Okay. And the reliquary has it has a tiny little pebble, and it says that's the last rock that killed St. James the Less, who was killed by stoning, you see. But that pebble is just like tiny, 4 inch across. Looks like it just had enough. Then we had even a penny dispensing machine.
Yeah.
With millions of those little pebbles. Now, each one was the last one that killed him. You would put a coin and you would get the last
pebble.
Where did
you get that idea from there, George?
Well, actually, there is a real early predecessor of flux object, and that was in Alexandrian school. Alexandria, they had a scientific community who just sat around thinking up of sometimes useful, sometimes completely useless objects, like toys, theater pieces. And they've done a lot of very valuable research in anatomy and mechanical engineering. That was like between 300 and 200 BC. So I discovered they had a coin-operated dispensing machine dispensing holy water, which was just squirted on you. You put a penny and pow, you
get it. Okay.
So in a sense that we took off. Then I discovered that during medieval times, monasteries were manufacturing relics. Right, and they were just making thousands of true nails and so on. Because there was a recent study somebody made a recent study of all the true nails of the cross.
Okay.
And found that there was like a couple tons. I mean, you could build a locomotive with it. Just literally every village in Europe has a true nail.
Oh, my God.
So, and with it, in that reliquary, there are all sorts of other objects that sort of make fun out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then every person in our group did some kind of boxes, and our last version was to put them all in a cabinet of drawers, so that we have 20 drawers, and maybe done by 10 different people.
I see.
And there would be one which has a dozen music movements, which you can turn them all together, like 12 different songs that can play simultaneously. Or that's the Joe Jones piece. He's doing a lot of work with automatic or self-playing musical instruments,
okay,
or music boxes. He would take a music movement from a music box and destroy some of the prongs, you know, like break off half of them. So you just have like bits and fragments of the song. Just like a couple tons keep repeating. And then there's some objects. There is also a recent object of Larry Miller. is a fan, for a ceiling fan, which goes as slow as a clock, very slow. And then another on a wall, there is a clock that has the fan motor, so it goes as fast as the fan. So you have two useless objects. Fan that doesn't cool, and yeah, and a clock that doesn't give time.
Okay. Where, what museums are these exhibited in, these boxes, that type of thing?
Well, up to like last year, no museum, and there were just two collectors. And there are two archives that originally started as archives of Dada collections, and then expanded into include flux objects. One is in Germany, Hans Sohm archives, and about equal size archive is in Tillingham in Massachusetts of Gene Brown. And that those archives have almost complete all our objects that we made, which must be like several hundred.
Several hundred.
Yeah, objects, documents, I mean, even furniture. There's like whole a quartet or orchestra of Joe Jones, all kinds of musical chairs that you would, like there is a chair where, they sort of like box-like chairs, and those were made by Takako Saito, who also has done like sound chess or musical chess pieces. But the chairs are very funny also, because they when they serve, like on one you may sit down and there would be a rolling ball inside. When you sit down, the ball rolls from one corner to another. You get up, it rolls again. Or another chair may produce a puddle of water underneath. Or another chair would squirt at your neighbor water. So you set them up for dinner, like, well, right.
Around the table.
Yeah. The table. Each chair is an event.
Well, George, let's get back a little bit. How did Fluxus get its start?
Well,
Alexandrian school, is that?
Yeah, it's in right Alexandrian school. Actually, the sort of more obvious start is in when the name was first used. In 1960, or I think it's 1961, fall, late 1961, and that was sort of direct influence. It was influenced directly by the school of John Cage that he had in the New School, where people like George Brecht, Dick Higgins, Jackson McClough were taking. In 1958 to 59, I think, they were taking a class. And all those people later were associated with Fluxus. Then there are sort of indirect influences of,
you've got quite a chart here.
Yeah, I have, yeah. Like, I would say, like, anti-art statements of Vladimir Mayakovsky, who influenced Henry Flynn directly. And Henry Flynn was sort of a peripheral flux person. Sometimes he was, sometimes he wasn't. But he was, I would say, a sympathetic observer.
Sympathetic observer.
Then I would say strong influence of like vaudeville and just plain gags of like Buster Keaton or Spike Jonze. Even if some of us may not have known of Spike Jonze, but he would definitely be like a precursor. And Futurist theater, I think, also played important part in influencing us. Then Marcel Duchamp is probably the greatest influence, and he influenced John Cage in turn, who influenced us.
Right.
And then the Dadas, but especially the Paris Dadas. They were doing more events then. In Zurich, they had some events in Cabaret Voltaire, but in Paris, they were doing almost like street events or tours and, you know, more varied kind of events rather than just a cabaret situation.
When are the street events starting to happen now? The street events are starting to happen now with the Dadas then?
They had events where there's one very famous one where the audience was, the way audience usually throw tomatoes at performance.
Right.
Performers, when they don't like it, well, here the performers came out with baskets of tomatoes. Started to throw them at the audience.
Right, I think we all that one. Yeah.
The futurists have done even before that. They've done things like they would have a whole play. They lift the curtain only like a couple of inches, and the whole play would go on behind. You just see the feet. They call it foot theater. But that's sort of similar to a piece of Ben Wattier, who has a lot of sort of theater shock pieces, as he calls. And there would be, for instance, a play going on, and all announced, so the people will come for that play, but the door is locked. Meanwhile, the play starts and goes on. And they just, you know, they hear all the noises, but they cannot get in.
Okay, so they're beating on the outside.
Or there is another audience piece like that, similar, where at the end of the concert, we would tell that, well, the last piece has to be performed in a secret place, and we have to take one row at a time to that place. So the usher will take the first row of people, they would follow him, and he would just take them down the back exit into the street, out of the theater. Meanwhile, the rest, you know, they all sort of drinking in anticipation, what's that next piece? And then just one, and they'll never know except when they actually go through it.
Right, so that goes on for an hour.
Yeah.
George, what's Flux?
Or there is a piece in the beginning where it works only with all the seats are numbered and the tickets also are numbered.
Right.
And in fact, that piece was done by the Futurists in 1913, I think, where... No, I think, yeah, the Futurists done a piece where the, like, 20 tickets would be sold to the same seat in the same evening. And then, you know, 20 people want to get to that chair and have a big fight. And
I think that's a danger piece.
Yeah, yeah. Then there is one where, again, they're numbered seats, and we just announced that, well, there was a terrible mistake made, and the person who has the sixth seat should change with 16, oh, you know? And then number four should change with 14. And, like, eh, big mess, everybody's changing their seats for the next half hour.
These are your concert, getting your concert things in.
Yes, so, as I was saying, in 1961, we were doing events and concerts of this sort. Not just we, there were many artists doing, like Lamont Young and Bob Morris. Yves Klein was doing even before that, like what he calls monotone symphony. And Ben Wattier was doing on his own in Nice. So 1959, happenings started of Alan Caprow.
Right.
Even though there were happenings before. Actually, the first happening was in 1952 at, it was called Concerted Action at Black Mountain College.
At Black Mountain.
Yeah,
right.
Where John Cage, Cunningham, and Rauschenberg performed. And the same year, Georges Mathieu did a happening painting, Battle of Bouvines. Now, few people know about him, yet he influenced the Japanese Gutai group, because he was in Japan in 1957, okay. And Gutai started in 1957.
Okay. And Gutai is the Japanese...
Sort of action happening group, okay. Yes. So that in 1960, there was a lot of this happening and events going on, and what happened right after that year, they sort of tended to break into two camps, like the serious and the humorous, and or I would call like neo-baroque and neo-haiku, you know, like haiku,
okay.
Here, one thing at a time, very simple, sort of like a gag. And neo-baroque would be like lots of things going on at the same time, like spectacles of Louis XIV in Versailles.
Right.
So, and meanwhile, like the humorous things would be like some of Buster Keaton gags.
Did these groupings take place in
very informally?
Or,
yeah, very informally, and they may not even have been aware that, or we may not have been aware that there were those groupings. But what happened is that our first plan was to publish a magazine, Fluxus, and that's how the name came about. And we just plugged the dictionary meaning, and there are several meanings, which anybody can look up. But it sort of naturally tended to attract people that were doing those humorous things. And then the name sort of stuck to, well, the magazine never came out in time. It came like 5 or 4 years after we started to plan it. We just found that it was too costly to do. But concerts were easy to do. So like in 1962, we had a whole series of concerts in Europe because it was especially easy to do them there. I just went like to Wiesbaden, mayor, and told him, well, we'd like to do a festival of American music, you know, new American music.
American music
he thought, well, you know, so
yeah.
He figured, okay, he didn't even know John Cage. Uh-huh. So he probably thought, I don't know what.
Benny Goodman.
Yeah, something like that. Oh, he said, yeah. Fine, yeah. He'll give us like 20, a theater in a museum for 20 concerts.
Yeah.
And then the first concert, and that's when the Flux Fest was used first, or something like it, Flux's concerts. The first concert, I remember, we obtained a sort of a real junk piano, grand piano that really was of, couldn't even be repaired. So we thought the best way to dispose of it would be to destroy it. And in fact, we like started a whole fad of destroying, you know, like after 1962, there were every college, they were destroying,
yeah,
but usually good pianos.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we had this piano, and then we found, we tried to do it very gentle way with screwdrivers. No, it wouldn't work. We just had to, you know, break it up with sledgehammers. Meanwhile, the audience and all the newspapers, they thought we were destroying the museum piano. They called us cultural Bolsheviks.
Oh, no.
Now, the mayor was in on vacation somewhere in Switzerland, so they recalled him. He almost lost his job. But they never asked us that where we got the piano. They just assumed it was the museum piano. Completely demolished. But they didn't stop us. I mean, we kept doing those concerts. Then we traveled to Copenhagen, Düsseldorf, Amsterdam, Hague, in Paris, then in Nice, which was sort of the end of the first European tour, I think it was 1964, where Ben Wautier was living. In fact, there's a whole group of French artists, like Armand is from Nice too, and so like many of the Nouveau Realists are connected with Nice. So sometimes they call Nice school. But the city itself is very conservative. So there, usually we had no problem with obtaining theaters, but in Nice, the theater director chickened out the last minute, and he didn't want to just close it in front of our faces, so he just called like truckfuls of police to surround the whole theater, and no audience, no performers admitted. So then we thought, well, if we can do it in a theater, we'll do it on the street. So that's how we started to do street performances. And Ben Wautier is very good state performer. He just loves to do it. And we done dozens of pieces, but there was one piece that really specially fitted Nice. In Nice, they have like the Grand Boulevard, which is right along the seashore, and
right.
On one side they're flanked by very fancy hotels, then the other side has the beach and the sea. And in the evening, like everybody's out on that boulevard, and all the cars just sort of drive back and forward
promenade
to show off. Yes,
yeah.
Like an automobile promenade. So we had we had like 8 performers all bunched together, very tight, and going in very tiny steps, like half-inch little steps, across the street, you know. And we had all like winter clothing and bowler hats, very all formally dressed.
Right.
And all the cars would have to stop and like wait for 10 minutes till we, you know, took all
this
way of crossing
the
we would cross the boulevard and then just continue on through the beach, down, down, down into the water. Until the bowler hats float away. Like a straight line.
Oh, beautiful.
But I saw recently a cartoon even, like in New Yorker magazine, I think. And that's like I would call it a Flux cartoon. They had a whole busload of executives were brought into the beach, and they all just marched
right
into the sea.
Right.
The same way.
Oh, my God.
But there are many events and objects that we haven't done that are sort of done not even as an art. Like, I think there's sometimes they're just sold like gags. I found one box that probably is from 1920s.
What exactly is Flux, George?
says on the top, for the man who has nothing. Then when you open the box, it's just smooth. There is no hollow, you know, like two blocks of wood. And then it says inside, and here is the place to keep it in, the nothing. And it's like there's absolutely no void inside the box. That would be a true flux object.
That's a beautiful.
So you got, Nice was about your first
Yes, then, well, then there's like Ben Wattier was very active, and he still is. He had a piece which he has done in Nice, and then we repeated it up here again. What he did in Nice, he took, chartered a bus, filled it up with people, and then took them up on a mountain, like a couple miles from the city. And then when they all got off the bus, he quickly came back with an empty bus. So they had to walk all the way back. It took them like 4 hours. Okay. Then we thought, we'll do that in New York. And they had some show where Ben was participating in Guggenheim Museum. So the museum provided us with a bus, and they thought we'll just tour the city or something. So we thought, all right, we'll, and it was midnight, and the fall in November was sort of drizzly night too. We thought, we'll go to the middle of the Bear Mountains, which is, you know, neither of us knew about Bear Mountains. And then we started to drive and on, we saw that was a very big forest. If we leave those people in there, they'll maybe freeze to death or something. So then we sort of had to improvise quickly some solution which wouldn't be so harsh. And we had all the people come out of the bus, and I gave everybody a flashlight. Then we said, now we're going to go up the little hill there to have like a picnic or some games, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And well, okay, they all following. A little suspicious, but you know, as long as we're around, they figure it's okay, because you know, we're with them. And meanwhile, I told the bus driver to drive like a half a mile to a different spot on the road and wait for us there. Now we went up to the little hill, and I say, well, for the next piece, now I have to collect all the flashlights. So I collected the flashlights and I ran off with them. So now they had to find their way through the dark to the spot where they thought the bus was. But and then the bus, meanwhile, had moved. So it took them a couple hours to get the bus.
Did you lose some friends that night?
No, actually, there were no friends in that bus. There were the strangers.
Oh, I see.
But probably they would never buy our objects.
No, not.
We had planned to do a big festival in San Gimignano in Italy, which is a very well-preserved, like 14th, 15th century town near Siena, where they still have all the towers that originally all the towns had. Oh, like 30 or 40 towers. So we thought we would do a piece especially for that city, for the town, using the towers. Like spin a giant spider web between the towers by, you know, shooting rope with arrows, or throwing down all kinds of noisemakers with parachutes from different tower, like alarm clocks or sirens or whatever. And also they have an interesting wall all around the town with two gates, rather high wall. So on completion of the festival, we were going to, as we leave, we would lock them in. So that instead of being locked out, they would be all locked in their town.
Did this come off?
Just the two gates. No, they all, when they saw our program,
they weren't <cheap. laughs>
they chickened out. But we may still do, we like to do for each different city, an event that fits the city, that there's some peculiarity in the city.
I see.
So, like for instance, here in Seattle, we plan to do a bus event, since the bus system is so well organized here. Well, I thought, you know, that would be like a compliment for the city do a special event for the bus. And the idea was to, originally, the idea was to, like, use the transfer system in such a way, in zigzag fashion, that you almost get in and get off the next stop and transfer to the next line and then off again.
Okay.
So that you can almost use up the whole bus system, not the, all the routes, but all the numbers of the buses.
I see.
But then I found out that there's sometimes a lot of waiting. Like 15 minutes, that would take like all week, maybe.
Right.
So I thought, well, the next best thing was to use this magic carpet system and just go back and forward, you know, like in a circle. Okay. Keep switching for a whole day, but not just passengers, but we'll say like 8 of us, and each with very giant package, like a big carton or a mattress or an umbrella that you cannot close, or a long tube or a big painting or something like that. And then we just keep coming in and out, so that eventually the drivers would see us, you know, like maybe an hour or two later, he would see the same group of people with the big packages coming in again. But it was raining that day, and nobody showed up.
Nobody
so
showed
the tour up. Didn't go off.
Okay.
It was bad luck with the rain.
Well, there was one other original piece that we'll talk about later. I hope that wasn't considered a compliment to the city. The toilet piece, which we'll You got into sports and games at one point.
Yes.
When was this?
Well, when we started to do street events, it sort of led naturally into game-like things. And then next thing, we were doing sports.
George, can you tell me what Flux is?
First sports, I think, in 1965 or so, where we were preparing ping pong rackets in different funny ways, like have a rock attached to it so it makes it very heavy, or a big hole inside, or you know, things like that. And then we were preparing badminton rackets in the same way. And then, or playing soccer on stilts, or try shot put with roller skates. You know, like, it's impossible, yeah. It goes nowhere, just a couple of feet from you. Because you roll back, as you throw, you roll back too.
Right.
So you need a action and this reaction thing has to work so that you're standing still on the ground. Or balloon javelins, or... you know, we were taking existing sports and like preparing them the way John Cage prepares a piano. So we could call it, you know, prepared sports. We had obstacle shoe races where the shoes would be prepared. Like, for instance, you take swimmers' flippers and extend them by attaching even like wooden boards, you know, so you're like a giant duck foot.
That's
like
appropriate.
4 feet long. Yeah, very hard to run with them. Or run on grass with roller skates. Or, like, so you couldn't bend your knees, you insert your leg in a paper tube. So you have to, like, run with the stiff legs or with crutches, you know, so every one would have a different kind of prepared. Handicaps, yeah, we call that handicap race,
right.
Yeah. Or we would have also handicap races where you would do something while you run. Like, we wanted to do one where people would be drinking a bottle of vodka while running.
A bottle,
you know,
of vodka?
Yeah, so that, you know, they start getting very tipsy as they come to the end. But then we were warned that you could get like a heart attack while you drank and ran at the same time. So we didn't do that. But, you know, there could be other ways, like eating porridge or something.
I see.
Or a Frankfurter while you ran, you know, and or writing some notes. So it always was doing something while running. And we had all kinds of bicycle events too, where, for instance, we called it multi-bike vehicle. And that was like a dozen. We never succeeded getting that many bikes, but the idea was to have like a dozen or more bicycles all tied together,
right,
but spaced apart so that each could actually operate it, but tied together with a frame So there would be like, say, three or four bicycles and maybe three or four rows of them, forming like quite a big square. It sort of occupies almost the whole street. And the curious thing is you can't steer it. It sort of goes straight. And no way of getting rid of it. I mean, like, you know, if police said we had to get off the road, there was no way. We had to.
Do you look for trouble, George, in your pieces?
No. We just like to do sort of like gags, you know, funny things. And we hadn't had, I can't think of any times when we had problems, you know, with the only time when they closed the theater in Nice, but, you know, they don't even know what we were going to do. And we are a very mild bunch, very pacifistic. Yeah.
Very lucky also.
Yeah, but we had some things that we planned that then we thought it would be too obstructive. Like, for instance, in New York on 5th Avenue and 42nd Street, it's sort of a very busy intersection. And we planned that four cars would converge on that intersection from four directions, and then all four have flat tire. But, you know, we didn't do that.
They put half of Manhattan to a standstill. Yeah.
Well, that's what we didn't want to do. We did, like, sort of like a game. There was a street cleaning event, which was done in front of Plaza Hotel in New York. But we got permission from Parks Department, and you know, it was very official. It said we're going to clean one like a square yard of the sidewalk. The permission said, you know, what tools we're going to use. Then there was even a Parks inspector that came to see that we really did the thorough cleaning of that square the way we said we would.
And
so
the tools.
We all dressed up like doctors with white coats and had just miniature tools like toothbrushes, toothpicks, you know, dentist tools, and all kinds of detergents, and then bleach, and then finally with alcohol. It was so white, that square. For a couple of weeks, it just remained like a big white square. Very, very clean.
What was the audience reaction?
Well, they thought we were selling brushes. You know, they said, what is this? What, we're selling brushes or cleaning fluids?
Looking for the cameras?
Yeah. Casiera Fluxes. Huh?
There was I think in 1966 or thereabouts, there was a big show of paper products and arts made with paper at the New York City Crafts Museum, and I think that was sponsored by Time and Life and some paper outfit, like I forget the name, one of the big paper manufacturers. So they asked us both for objects, of which we had several, and also to do a concert, like a theater piece, or paper piece. So we did two pieces. One was like an orchestra playing paper, different paper sounds, and the other one was a sort of like a dramatic event, a curtain, paper curtain, and there was one archer in Japanese samurai armor, looked very menacing. He shot 12 arrows into the paper curtain, and each time the arrow would hit the curtain, the paper curtain would react like the first time the arrow may bounce off, because we would have like piece of plywood behind. Then a man behind the curtain would spray blue ink or paint, so it would look like the spot where the arrow was hit started to get blue, you know, the way the skin gets from impact. Or the next arrow went right through the paper, like it got absorbed by it, and then only the feathers came out. Like, you know, the body rejected the feathers. It consumed the arrow but not the feathers. Or, you know, it would bleed, like shaving cream come out, or gong. We would have sometimes a gong behind. So it would hit through the paper, it would hit the gong.
Okay.
So they were all sound and visual things. Sort of, they ended up to be all like funny, you know, the whole idea was like a funny concept. Because, as I say, that's sort of a strong element in most of our things, are this element of humor, which is carried sometimes when even an artist doesn't particularly think he's doing humorous thing, but it ends up to look like, you know, humorous.
Well, it seems to me that the title of that piece was Kill Paper, Not People. Is that
right? Yeah. Well, that was sort of, you know, also two T's, and we were killing that paper. And oh, the last thing he came, you see, it was all done like a Japanese attack of arrows, and then he came with a sword and cut the curtain in the bottom, like barrels. Then we had a big paper, from paper tube, like a truss structure, a three-dimensional space frame.
Yes.
That came out right over the audience and just sat down on the audience. So they were all like, in a cage, you know, because it just, that's how it reminds me of another event where we asked to do just a piece or performance for some benefit, concert, which had was followed by like a big dance, like ballroom dance. And so we were all dressed up like workers, and we were just hanging, actually we were hanging scotch tape on the ceiling like a big net. Now people thought we were just hanging decoration like ribbons, you know, and they always kept saying, why are those workers working here when we're dancing, you know, couldn't they have done it before? We had our overalls, and I just said flux worker. Then when we all hung it up, big network of scotch tape, then it was supported at 4 points only. So at one signal, we could cut all those 4 points, and the whole net came down on the dancers with scotch tape. They were completely
entangled.
Yeah, with all sticky stuff. Yeah, man, they were angry, the dancers.
Did you do any food for that?
No, not for that, but we usually did food events, like when we have New Year's party, we do each New Year different kind of food event. So the first one, also in the 60s, we did, the theme was to have funny foods, and everybody had to invent some kind of a funny food. So, well, there was a fish, live fish floating in a fish soup, or there was an egg, which, hard-boiled egg that had no yellow in it, only
no
the white.
Yolk.
Yeah, no yolk.
How was that?
You see, you take a raw egg, blow the whole egg out through two little holes, and then with a syringe you put back only the egg white. And then you hard boil, and you just get a hard boiled egg. Or there were other things, instead of egg you could put, like we put dry noodles through the little hole, and then boil the whole thing, the noodles will expand, and when you peel it up and it looks like, you know, brains. like a chicken has just been there, you know, hatched with only brains. So, you know, everybody invented some food. Then we've done other New Year time, food events where like a rainbow, once where we did rainbow colors. All food was set up like a rainbow on a black tablecloth. Or the most recent one we did, we called Food Atlas, where everybody had to bring food from a different country, and then we set it up as a map.
As a map?
A map of the world, yeah. And then we ate the map up.
Mm-hmm.